but at least he took good care of both. The two of them, three if you counted Judith, had not been anticipated in Bichoraro until the next day, but had decided to take advantage of the cool temperatures to make the drive after sundown. Judith used to be the most beautiful woman in Bichoraro. But then she'd moved, and now she was the most beautiful woman in Colorado Springs. She was so beautiful that people would stop her on the street and thank her. She had gone to school to learn how to make her blue-black hair do whatever she wanted it to do, and now she made other women's hair do what she wanted it to do in a small hairdresser shop where she worked with several other women. Her lips were the same rosebud as her younger sister Beatrice's, only Judith painted hers a bloody red that set off her flawless brown skin and gleaming dark hair. She had been wearing artificial eyelashes in the womb, and when they had fallen off in the birth canal, she had lost no time in replacing them. Where Beatrice took after their father, Francisco, Judith was more like volatile Antonia. Here was a thing she wanted. To have two gold teeth where no one could see them but she would know they were there. Here was a thing she feared. Having to fill out forms before medical appointments of any kind. Eduardo was the most handsome of the Costas, which was saying a lot, but he was not so handsome that people would stop him on the street to thank him. The Costas were cowboys and bred quarter horses for the rodeo. The Costas and their horses were all fast and charming, and could turn on a dime faster than you could say, ¿qué onda? They were also very good at what they did, and neither the Costas nor their horses would ever kick a child. Eduardo wore clothing even fancier than his wife's. Bright red cowboy shirts to match her lips, and tight black pants to match her hair, and blocky fleece-colored leather coats to emphasize her shapeliness. Here was a thing he wanted. For singers to pause in their singing to laugh during a verse. Here was a thing he feared. Cats lying on his face and smothering him while he slept. Judith and Eduardo took stock of the scene as they pulled into the compound. The enormous wood-covered Mercury, the Italian-American perched on top of it, the square silhouette of Pete inside, the slobber of dogs drawing picturesque arcs across the diorama.
"Ed, do you recognize that car?" Judith asked.
Eduardo removed his cigarette to say,
"It's last year's Mercury Colony Park in sunburst yellow."
Judith said,
"I meant, do you recognize the man on top of it?"
"Then you should have said, do you recognize the man on top of it?"
"Do you recognize the man on top of it?"
Eduardo framed Tony DiRisio with his headlights as he approached, Tony shielded his eyes, and peered closely.
"No, but I like that suit."
One of the dogs had just gotten a hold of the left sleeve of the aforementioned white suit, and Tony, accepting discretion as the better part of valor, allowed the dog to have the entire coat rather than his left arm.
"It's just like Mama to leave them out here," Judith said angrily.
"I bet she's making one of those flowers."
"Don't talk about her,"
Judith said, even though she had been about to say the same thing herself. The Chevy nosed up beside the Mercury. It was just high enough that Eduardo Costa and Tony DiRisio were now eye to eye. Eduardo honked his horn to startle one of the dogs off the hood of the Mercury. Then he removed the cigarette from his lips and gave it to Tony.
"Hola, traveler," Eduardo said.
Judith patted her hair and leaned into the conversation.
"Are you here for a miracle?"
Tony sucked the cigarette, then flicked it at one of the dogs.
"Lady, it would be a miracle to get off the roof of my car."
Eduardo leaned out of his window and called into the Mercury.
"Are you here for a miracle, mijo?"
Pete started.
"I'm here about a truck."
"He's here about a truck," Eduardo told his wife.
"Papa should shoot these dogs," Judith replied.
"Bullets are too afraid to hit them,"
Eduardo observed. He took his time lighting another cigarette and smoking it as they all watched him.
Then he kissed his wife, stroked his mustache, opened the door of the truck, and jumped lightly out, his sharp cowboy boots raising dust as he landed. Antonia's dogs turned to him. An owl hooted. A creature howled from inside one of the distant cabins. The moon smiled cunningly. Then, Eduardo hurled down his cigarette butt and began to run. Man and dogs flew across the yard into the dark. The Costas are known for their bravery and for their smoking. In the quiet left behind, Judith climbed from the truck. She was very nervous, but she did not show it as she walked over to the Mercury with a sway that matched her beauty.
Let's get you men a place to sleep and we can see about... Beatrice, what are you doing lurking over there?
Beatrice was not lurking. She was standing motionless and observant in the deepest of the shadows beside her mother's house, so silent that even Antonia's dogs had not known she was there. She had been waiting for her opportunity to climb back into her bedroom, but Judith, with the uncanny intuition that sisters sometimes have, had seen her there.
There are no beds,
Beatrice told Judith.
None of the pilgrims have left since you did. No beds? Impossible.
Judith had not been back to Bicho Raro in months.
It's true,
said a voice from within the long stucco building. This was one of the pilgrims. They were always eavesdropping, as the forbidden lives of the Sorias were very interesting to them. They had been listening to the exchange outside just as much as the other Sorias had been. And now, this voice floated out of the building in a way that seemed ghostly to Pete and Tony. It added,
"The floor is available, though."
"Don't talk to me,"
Judith snapped to the unseen pilgrim. Although the statement seemed unfriendly to Pete and Tony, her exhortation was actually colored by fear. All of the Sorias treated the pilgrims with caution, but Judith was more than cautious. She was frightened of them. This was one of the reasons Judith had moved away as soon as she'd gotten married and had not returned before now. She could not take the tension of living alongside them all day and all night long.
Beatrice said, "Michael's building a lodge, but it's not done." "A lodge?"
Judith was nearly overcome, imagining an entire lodge full of pilgrims.
"We are not a hotel." "Fine, fine. These men can have the miracle and go on their way or sleep on the floor. Which of you wants to be first? The father or son?"
"Lady, just how old do I look?" Tony asked. "I only met this kid today."
"I'm just here about work, ma'am,"
Pete said quickly. He had been listening to this conversation with growing certainty that Tony had come here for a very different reason than him. He felt he needed to distance himself from it in case it was illegal.
"Work?"
echoed Judith, with considerable confusion.
"No miracle?"
"Not for me, ma'am."
This captured Beatrice's notice. People who came to Bicho Raro in the dark of night were always either a member of the Soria family or in search of a miracle. Here was the stranger, however, and he was neither. She interjected,
"You aren't a pilgrim?"
"No more than any of us are, I suppose."
This exchange was when Pete and Beatrice first truly noticed each other. They used this moment of observation in two different but related ways. Beatrice observed Pete with his arm crooked on the edge of the Mercury's open window, and wondered what it would be like to press her thumb gently into the skin at the inside of his elbow. She could see this crook of his arm from where she stood, and it seemed as if it would be a soft and pleasant thing to do. Beatrice had never had this impulse before, and was somewhat surprised by it. She was equally surprised by how the feeling, once noticed, did not go away, but instead extended to the other elbow as well. Because she was Beatrice, she made a note to consider this impulse more acutely later, to determine where it might have come from. She did not consider this sensation to be a suggestion for future action, however. Pete, for his part, observed Beatrice in the half-shadow with her still, unblinking, eerie manner, her expression looking no warmer than those of the dark-eyed barn owls sitting on the roof above her. Although they had exchanged only a handful of words, Pete felt the most dangerous jolt to his heart so far, surpassing even what he had felt when he had fallen in love with the desert only hours before. He did not know the reason for this surge of intense curiosity, only that the scale of it felt deadly. It seemed that he should not repeat it, if at all possible. He pressed his hand to his chest and vowed to keep his distance from Beatrice while he worked here.
"I'll wait in the car,"
he said hastily, and rolled the window back up.
"In my car?" Tony demanded.
There was no time for further discussion, as the sound of Antonia's dogs echoed back through Bicho Raro. Eduardo Costa had done a fine job leading them away, but he had run out of breath at a collapsed cattle barn near the highway and had climbed it to preserve his life. The dogs had left him marooned on the ruined spine of the building, and were now returning to make a meal of Tony's other shoe.
"We should go before the dogs get to us," Judith said.
She looked to Beatrice, but Beatrice had already vanished. She could not be persuaded to talk to strangers if there was anyone else who would do it instead, and she most certainly did not like to be volunteered to perform the miracle. Also, unknown to Judith, she wanted to study the feeling she had had about Pete more closely, and worried that another feeling might come along and make it more complicated to analyze.
"Beatrice," Judith hissed.
Then, to Tony,
"Hurry up, follow me."
The sound of the dogs lent Tony speed. He limped after her on his one shod foot, one sock foot.
"Where are we going?"
"Where do you think?"
Judith replied angrily.
"To get you your miracle."
Chapter 4. The saint of Bicho Raro sat in the shrine and listened to Tony Di Riccio approach. The shrine was the oldest building in Bicho Raro. It had been designed and built by Felipe Soria, a member of the family now spoken of only in hushed tones. He had arrived in Bicho Raro on a large honey-colored horse and in a large honey-colored hat, and promptly began work on a roadside altar after claiming that the Virgin had appeared to him with instructions to do so. On the first day, he'd completed the stucco walls for a small structure the size of his stallion's box stall, and the other Sorias had been pleased. On the second day, he'd torn free a section of abandoned railroad and melted it into a beautifully intricate metal gate, and the other Sorias had been pleased. On the third day, he'd fired 1,000 ceramic tiles with the heat of his own belief, and installed a roof made of them, and the other Sorias had been pleased. On the fourth day, the Virgin had appeared again, this time surrounded by owls. He'd carved a statue of her in this state to place inside the shrine, and the other Sorias had been pleased. On the fifth day, he'd made a rich pigment from some sky that had gotten too close to him and used it to paint the shrine's exterior turquoise, and the other Sorias had been pleased. On the sixth day, he'd held up a passenger train, robbed the passengers, killed the sheriff on board, and used the sheriff's femurs to fashion a cross for the top of the shrine. The Sorias had not been pleased. On the seventh day, Felipe Soria had gone missing forever, which was why the Sorias now spoke of him only in whispers. When he was young, Joaquin had once told his mother, Rosa, that he'd seen Felipe Soria wandering the desert outside Bicho Raro, but Felipe would have been 130 years old, so no one believed him. The Sorias were long-lived, except when they suddenly weren't. But such an age would have been exceptional, even for a Soria. As Judith Soria Costa escorted Tony to the shrine, the current saint of Bicho Raro kneeled inside its small interior. He had run all the way from the box truck in order to have time to prepare himself, spiritually,
to perform the miracle and prepare himself physically to appear as the saint. He did not have to do this, as even Soria's in poor standing with God remained miraculous, but he believed that the more spiritually prepared he was during the ritual, the more likely the pilgrim was to be completely healed. The miracles, he felt, were just as much about healing his own mortal spirit as theirs. Daniel Lupe Soria had not always been on the path to holiness. As a child, he'd been so terrible that Rosa Soria had sent him twice to be exorcised. He'd been so terrible that he'd chased a field of sheds out into the road one week and burned down a herd of cattle the next. He'd been so terrible that the cowboys at the neighboring ranch still used his name as a cuss word. In his teens, he and his school friends had decided to steal a painting of the Santo Niño de Atocha from a church outside Alamosa. As the disguised child Jesus gazed reproachfully from inside the frame, Daniel had carried the icon outside to where his friends waited in their truck. As he descended the few stairs, however, the painting grew heavier and heavier until he was compelled to put it down. His friends jeered, but they could not move it either. As Daniel had tried to decide if they should just leave the painting where it sat on the sidewalk, he'd seen an inscription on the back, donated by an anonymous benefactor for all the crooked saints. Feeling suddenly and surprisingly heavy with the weight of both religious paintings and remorse, Daniel could not bring himself to abandon the painting to the elements his crime had exposed it to. He decided to wait with it until the priest returned in the morning, even if it meant confessing his theft. His friends abandoned him, but still Daniel waited. The wind began to kick up dirt, and still Daniel waited. A storm blew in, and hail began to fall, and he covered the painting with his body to protect it. And still he waited. As the hailstones pounded him, the frivolous and selfish nature of his childhood exploits hit him with equal pain. With each blow of the hail, he repented of another misdeed. Then, the sky cleared, and Daniel found that he could easily lift the painting. A miracle. He'd returned it to its place in the church, and had been the saint of Bichoraro ever since. He still had a divot in his shoulder from the first hailstone that had hit him that night. A physical reminder that regret stings. Now, as he waited for Tony to come to him, he fell once more into prayer. He had been praying all day, stopping only to go out with Beatriz and Joaquin. The day of prayer was not unusual, as Daniel began to pray when the sun rose and often continued praying after the sun had set, setting out words and lighting candles for his family and each of the pilgrims who had already come, and each of the pilgrims who were still on their way to him. It was unusual for the saint to pray for himself. Now Judith's voice came to him from outside the shrine. She was asking the pilgrim, "Are you prepared to change your life?"
"Yeah, yeah," the pilgrim replied.
The saint turned back to his prayers. Some saints had a profound relationship with God, or the Holy Child, or a particular saint. But Daniel preferred to direct his prayers toward Mother. This figure in his mind was both the Virgin Mary and his own mother, the one he had never known, having been delivered from her dead body as a newborn. So now he prayed, "Mother, help me to help this man." And he also prayed, "Mother, help me." The miracles at Bichoraro always came in twos. The first miracle was this, making the darkness visible. Sadness is a little like darkness. They both begin the same way. A tiny, thin pool of uneasiness settles in the bottom of the gut. Sadness simmers fast and boils hard, and then billows up and out, filling first the stomach, then heart, then lungs, then legs, then arms, then up into the throat, then pressing against eardrums, then swelling against skull and eventually spilling out of eyes in a hissing release. Darkness, though, grows like a cave formation. Slow drips from the uneasiness harden over the surface of a slick knob of pain. Over time, the darkness crusts in unpredictable layers, growing at such a pace that one doesn't notice it has filled every cavern under the skin until movement becomes difficult or even impossible. Darkness never boils over. Darkness remains inside. But a Soria could draw it out and give it form. They would feel a stirring of the pilgrim's darkness as it drew near, like the owls, and the promise of their gift inside their mouths, like a song they knew the words to. There was barely a pause between when they chose to draw the darkness out and when the darkness began to emerge. Daniel's head was still bowed and his eyes closed when Tony entered the shrine. Because of this, and the dim light afforded by 100 tiny candles, Tony did not see young Daniel Lupe Soria when his eyes grew accustomed. He saw only the saint. The saint had long black hair, parted evenly to his shoulders. His face was a ragged chalk white, his brown skin painted with a pale paste made from the dust of the surrounding area. His eye sockets were smeared black like a skull. His knuckles bore a spider's 8 wide-open eyes. In this light, he looked less like a human you would meet, and more like a thing that you would discover. Tony noticed the Catholic artifacts in the shrine, the rosary beads around the saint's neck, but they seemed to belong to a different Catholicism than the perfunctory, godless form he had practiced back in Philadelphia. Tony suddenly realized how cold it was here in the high desert night. The owls carved beside Mary seemed to be looking at him. "Do you have darkness in you?" the saint asked, his eyes still closed. Tony's heart quailed inside him. He felt he had heard this story before, and it had ended badly for the radio DJ who'd driven his Mercury into the desert. He thought he might just go, leave that kid here pining after a truck, and keep on driving west toward California, right into the sea. The saint of Bicho Raro opened his eyes. Tony looked into them. There were many reasons why Daniel Lupe Soria was the best saint that Bicho Raro had experienced for generations. But his eyes were on the top of the list. Eyes like his had not been seen for 100 years. It might have been possible for someone else to look as gentle and holy as Daniel Lupe Soria did, but only if one had the right eyebrows. Eyebrows are extraordinarily important to expression. They say that if you shave off your eyebrows, babies cannot recognize you. Daniel, however, did not require his eyebrows to accomplish his mystical expression. Just his eyes alone would do the trick. They were wide-set, dark brown, and full of an otherworldly kindness that meant that not only did he love you, but any other possible otherworldly entity you believed in was looking through them and also loved you. If the Catholic Church had looked into Daniel Lupe Soria's eyes in the 19th century, they would have offered to do battle with the Mexican government on the Soria family's behalf. If the Mexican government had looked into Daniel Lupe Soria's eyes in the 19th century, they would have at once become better Catholics. "Oh," said Tony. He kneeled. Daniel reached out and brushed Tony's eyes closed with his palm. Then he closed his own again. They both sat this way in the complicated blackness that exists behind closed eyelids. Tony imagined static playing on his radio station. Daniel imagined the rain pouring on Marisita Lopez and the trapped butterflies on her dress. The second miracle was this: getting rid of the darkness for good. No one wanted to see their darkness made manifest, but the reality was that it could not be fought until you saw its shape. Unfortunately, the pilgrims had to do the fighting on their own, and only then, once they had seen their darkness and learned how to banish it, could they leave Bichoraro healed and bright. There was a law laid down among the Sorias to not interfere. If a Soria lifted a hand or breathed a word in aid, a darkness would fall on the Soria as well, and a saint's darkness was an even more terrible and powerful thing. "Answer me now," Daniel said. "Do you have darkness inside you?"
"Yes," Tony said.
"And do you want to be rid of it?" This is a harder question to answer than one might think at first blush. Almost no one would think it's correct to answer this question with a no, but the truth is that we men and women often hate to be rid of the familiar, and sometimes our darkness is the thing we know the best.
"Yes."
Outside, owls began to flap and call out. Horned owls hooted. Screech owls trilled. The barn owls gave their metallic hiss. Barred owls meowed. Spectacled owls barked hollowly. Pygmy owls peeped. The elf owls laughed nervously. The noise escalated to cacophony as the air turned ever more miraculous. Daniel opened his eyes again. The darkness began to appear. Chapter 5. The owls ordinarily roosted once the miracle took place. That night, they did not leave until the saint told them to go. Chapter 6. The morning after a miracle is always bright. This is because nearly every morning in Bichoraro is bright. Colorado has long boasted that it enjoys 300 days of sunshine a year, which is not actually true, but it is close enough to the truth to feel like it. The morning following Tony Di Riccio's miracle did nothing to disprove the claim. The sun had been climbing hand over foot through the dry Colorado blue for several hours, and Bichoraro was beginning to warm. Beatriz Soria had woken up before everyone else, despite the lateness of the previous night. Her mind was very active while she was awake, and didn't stop when she slept, so she usually did not spend much time doing the latter. That day, before dawn, she had used her retractable secret bridge to climb from her window without waking her mother in the room beside her. From there, she drifted across the silent compound to the telescope. The telescope was a parabolic radio telescope, 60 feet wide and about 80 feet tall. A scooped dish of metal rods pointed hopefully at the sky. Its skeletal shadow moved around its base like a giant sundial. With the cooperation of some of the more tax-savvy Sorias, the telescope had been constructed during the '50s, ostensibly to monitor the weather, but practically to spy on the Russians, and had been decommissioned after only one use. The head engineer on the project would not report on what his team had picked up with the tracker, only that everyone else would sleep better at night having not seen it. Later, everyone on the team quietly moved to colder climates in distant countries. Beatriz now used it as a place to think. Sometimes she climbed the ladder 40 feet into the air and observed Bichoraro from the metal mesh platform. And sometimes she removed her shoes and climbed past even that, feet pressed into metal bars and legs hooked over supports on the backside of the dish, sometimes dangling, sometimes clinging, until she managed to heave herself over the rim of the dish and into it. Then she would lie inside the metallic nest of the dish and stare up at the sky, imagining herself, her mind, that is, the important part of herself, being projected as far up into the sky as she could see. She would hold her thoughts up there for hours at a time, breathing them back into the altitude if they started to drift down, and then, finally, she would turn those distant thoughts back down to Bichoraro and consider her home from that great height instead. Things came into better perspective, she felt, when viewed from 1,000 feet. Sometimes Daniel would join her, the only other person Beatrice had found so far who she could share her sanctuary with. Although they were very different, they shared one important trait. They did not try to change other people, and rarely judged them unless the other person's values directly influenced their lives. For Daniel, this meant that he had, before his incident with the painting, hung out with young men whom others found to be of dubious character. For Beatrice, this meant that she had often frustrated Judith by refusing to take sides in moral discussions or disagreements. This trait also made Daniel and Beatrice good conversation partners. A debate without a goal of philosophical interference can continue endlessly without drama. One of their earliest radio dish discussions had centered around who could receive a miracle. A pilgrim had just abandoned a fractious stallion at Bichoraro, and the horse's famously ill temperament was the topic of every Soria conversation. Beatrice and Daniel, then 10 and 12, had looked down into the pasture from that great height and speculated upon whether they, as Sorias, could visit their miracle upon an animal. Daniel argued that a horse's lack of humanity presented an insurmountable problem for the second miracle. Even if the saint could manifest its darkness, surely the horse lacked the moral certainty to come to an understanding of how to banish it. The second miracle would never occur, and the horse would therefore live out its days plagued by the same darkness that had previously lived inside it, now made worse by being given concrete form. Beatrice agreed that the horse's lack of humanity was indeed the obstacle, but she believed that the saint wouldn't be able to perform even the first miracle. Humanity, she maintained, was necessary for darkness to exist. Without an understanding of the concept of darkness, morality, or other existential subjects, the unpleasantness inside the individual could not be darkness, but rather simply nature, and thus could not be cured with a miracle, or perhaps at all. "So, that horse will be terrible forever?" Daniel had asked.
"I do not think that darkness is about being terrible."
It had taken slightly longer for 10-year-old Beatrice to find the words that she needed. She had still been learning how to live with the hard truth that the most interesting parts of her thoughts usually got left behind when she tried to put them into words. There were often very long pauses as she strove for a perfect translation.
"I think the darkness is about shame."
Daniel had contemplated the pilgrims he had already seen in his 12 years.
"I think you're right.
We were nearly in agreement in the beginning,"
Beatrice had added in order to be a gracious winner. Daniel had grinned.
"Nearly."
On the day after Tony's miracle, Beatrice was alone as she climbed to the platform above the layer of dark dust. Then, as the sun slowly began to warm her cold blood into movement, she watched her home come to life. She could see most of it from her perch, as Bichoraro occupied a fairly small footprint. There was a dusty, bare parking area at its heart. Buildings gathered around this like hands around a fire. Only a dozen or so were still standing. 3 houses, 3 barns, her father Francisco's greenhouse, her Aunt Rosa's camper, 3 sheds, the shrine. The dirt drive led through these, past the cistern, and then out to Highway 160, the only paved road for miles. Both the drive and the highway were barely better than the surrounding scrub, which one could drive through too if your vehicle was eager. One might even end up doing it, even with an uneager vehicle, if the night was thick enough, because there was not a lot of difference between the cracked asphalt and the dusty expanse it cut through. It was easy to lose your way without headlights. which is true of a lot of life. Surrounding all of this was the high desert that Pete had fallen in love with, and that had fallen in love with him. It was broken only by scurfy tamarisk and sage and near-invisible twists of barbed wire until it got to the mountains. Beatrice observed it all from her perch, paying less attention to the nature and more attention to the small humans moving below her. She did not particularly enjoy physical labor, but she found it satisfying to watch other people engaged in it. She liked to watch the things they did that were unnecessary. It is, after all, not the tasks people do, but the things they do around the edges of them that reveal who they are. For instance, from the dishes platform she could see her second cousin Luis repairing some barbed wire that the cows had run through during the last big thunderstorm. He was cutting out some sections and restretching others. Every so often, however, he would move his fingers in the air and she would know that he was practicing his guitar in his mind. She could also see Nana working in the tomatoes behind her house. She was on her ancient hands and knees, weeding. But twice Beatrice saw her sit back on her rump and place a raw, fresh tomato in her mouth to savor. Beatrice also saw her Aunt Rosa, Joaquin's mother, carrying peppers and the baby Lydia back to her home for cooking. The peppers, not the baby. Rosa's steps were slowed by pausing to sing and plant kisses into the top of Lydia's head. Beatrice knew from experience that this ratio increased throughout the course of the day, until no work got done and only kisses were given. A tremolo cry pulled Beatrice's attention from the ground to the sky just above her. Squinting against the brightness, she discovered that several owls had gathered on the rim above her head, their talons making familiar scratching sounds against the metal. The group was made up of multiple species. Two barn owls, a barred owl, and a small owl of a kind Beatrice had not seen before. Most people, in fact, had not seen this kind of owl before, as it was the rare buff-fronted owl, a native of distant Peru. Because of how surely the miracles appealed to owls, Beatrice, like all the Sorias, was used to their presence, although, unlike most of the other Sorias, she had spent many long hours wondering if the owl's attraction to miracles was beneficial or harmful. There was, after all, a large difference between the way flowers drew hummingbirds and the way artificial light compelled moths. A banded feather drifted down. Beatrice snatched for it, but the action of snatching displaced both air and feather, and it continued its slow descent to the ground below.
"Why are you still here?"
she whistled in her invented language. The owls didn't startle at her voice. Instead, they continued to stare at her in their wide-open way. The buff-fronted owl that had come so far turned its head on one side to better study her. She was not sure that they were the same owls from the night before after all, though if that was true, she wasn't sure what they were being attracted to.
"No darkness here," she whistled. "No miracles, anyway."
Their gazes continued to be so purposeful that she looked back to the ground to see if another pilgrim had arrived without her knowing. But the only person she saw was Michael, Rosa's husband, thrusting a shovel into a patch of dirt. For as long as Beatrice had known him, he had done nothing but work or sleep. To understand Michael, you only had to understand the project at hand, which in this case was the log lodge Beatrice had mentioned the night before. Currently, the lodge was only four pieces of wood sunk into the ground. It was merely the promise of a building, and had grown no further, not because of Michael's unwillingness to do the work, but rather because it was a point of contention, questioned at every stage. Judith was not the only one who argued that it didn't need to be built. The building was not really the problem. The pilgrims were the problem. There is a plant that still grows in Colorado today called the tamarisk. It is also called the salt cedar. It is not a native plant. In the 1930s, a dust storm had arrived in the middle of the United States and raged for years. To keep all the states between Colorado and Tennessee from blowing away, farmers had planted millions of tamarisk shrubs to hold the ground down. Once its job was done there, the enterprising tamarisk had packed its bags and moved to the southwestern corner of the United States to stay. In bloom, it is very lovely, with tiny pink flowers made beautiful by their unusual combination of tender color and physical durability. When it is not in bloom, it is an enormous plant of extreme hardiness, so suited to growing in Colorado that when it is present, no other plant can compete with it. Massive, unwieldy roots dig deep into the soil, drinking all the water and using all of the salt, eventually making the only suitable neighbor for tamarisk, yet more tamarisk. This is what the pilgrims had become at Bicho Raro. They had been arriving at the same pace, but leaving at a far slower one. For some reason, they could not seem to perform the second miracle on themselves with the same efficiency as past generations. So they loitered in their partially changed states, benevolently draining Bicho Raro's resources. The Sorias did not dare help. They had all been told the danger of interfering with miracles, and no one wanted to be the one to risk bringing darkness on themselves and the rest of their family. The simplest solution would have been to throw these overflowing pilgrims into the desert to fend for themselves. But even if Danielle had not been around to protest the ethics of this, the memory of Elizabeth Pantazopoulos stopped the rest of the Sorias. Elizabeth Pantazopoulos had rolled into Bicho Raro at some point in the 1920s, wearing a man's striped prison uniform and bearing a bullet wound in her left arm. In the crook of her good arm, she had been carrying a long-haired cat that also had a bullet wound in one limb. She had not volunteered the circumstances that had brought her to this point. She'd merely received the first miracle and remained at Bicho Raro until her gunshot wound had healed and the cat no longer flinched at knocking sounds. Then, she had managed to perform the second miracle on herself and was gone the next morning. The Sorias had heard nothing more from her until 4 years later, when a packet had arrived from New York City with three things in it. One, a piece of paper saying simply, "Thank you, yours, Elizabeth Pantazopoulos." Two, a bullet, presumably from either her arm or the cat's. And three, a pile of cash large enough to see Bicho Raro through the more difficult years of the Depression. You just can't guess who will strike it big. So the pilgrims stayed, and the Sorias resentfully built a lodge. Beatrice moved her attention beyond Michael and the lodge to the very large wood-paneled Mercury station wagon still parked in the dust beyond it. Making binoculars of her hands to shield her eyes from the sun, she focused on the interior. She could see Pete Wyatt's boots through the back window. He was either sleeping or dead. To her continued surprise, the urge to place her thumb on his skin had not diminished, even though she could not even see his elbows from where she sat. In an effort to study this feeling objectively, Beatrice imagined it rising out of her mind and up into the air above the telescope, hoping to disentangle the emotion from her untrustworthy body. To her annoyance, however, it refused to float above her. Some feelings are rooted too strongly in the body to exist without it, and this one, desire, is one of them. Beatrice was aware of this form of attraction from observation, but not from personal experience. She contemplated the absence of logic in the sensation, and then considered the more emotional members of her family, wondering if this was what they felt like all the time. Beatrice watched Pete's boots and pondered her puzzling feeling for such a duration and with such an intensity that she noticed neither the departure of the owls above her nor the arrival of Marisita López below her. Marisita stood at the telescope's base,
one hand lifted to protect her eyes against the rain that always fell on her. The dust around her puffed and splattered under the assault of the precipitation. The butterflies on her dress moved their sluggish wings, but did not fly. She gazed uncertainly up at Beatrice. Her errand was urgent enough to encourage her to break the rule against speaking with Sorias, but still she hesitated. This was because Beatrice could be quite frightening from the outside. Right now, La Chica Sin Sentimientos got a stark and haunting image up on the telescope platform. Motionless, speechless, unblinking. She was, in many ways, like the owls that had just been perched above her, particularly the ghost-faced barn owls with their inscrutable expressions. Marisita had come from Texas to Bichoraro, and on the border where she lived, owls were considered with distrust. The problem lay not with the owls themselves, but rather with the lechuzas, witches who could transform themselves into owls with human faces. Even though Marisita trusted the intentions of the Sorias, there was no pretending that they didn't have otherworldly abilities. And although she did not believe the church had been correct to drive them from Abejones, it was not difficult for her to see how she, as one of the Sorias' troubled pilgrims, also did not belong in a church. It was just that Marisita was not sure that saints and witches were very different in the end. And Beatrice was the most saintly of the Sorias, apart from Daniel. Which meant that Marisita did not feel bold enough to shout up to her that Daniel Soria had given her a letter meant for Beatrice. She merely trapped the paper between the metal rung of the ladder and the metal riser, and made sure that it would not fall out on its own, moving quickly so that her rain-damp hands did not spoil it. She didn't know what the letter said. She had been told not to read the letter, so she had not read it. She could not know how its contents would impact them all.
"Beatrice? Beatrice Soria? I have something for you," she shouted,
but only in her mind. Marisita often said things only in her mind. This is not generally an efficient way of speaking, as very few people are mind readers, apart from Delecta Marsh, who had received mind reading as a result of the first miracle back in 1899. But Delecta was long dead, shot by an immediately excommunicated and now also dead abbot, and so in reality, Marisita merely twisted her hands together and hoped that Beatrice might notice her and come for the letter. She did not, and Marisita grew no braver. Marisita began to cry, just a little. Her tears were not only from anxiety. They were the kind of tears that come easily because earlier tears have already smoothed the path for them. The night before, when Tony and Pete had arrived, she had been considering a terrible decision. The decision was this: whether or not she should walk out into the desert without any food and proceed until she could no longer remember who she was. If you think this sounds like a painful way to die, know that Marisita had also considered this and decided upon it for that very reason. It was, she thought, what she deserved. But now Daniel had given her this mysterious letter to deliver, and he had told her it was important. She could not go into the desert until she knew what it meant. She felt trapped in between. She had not truly wanted to go the night before, but she hadn't wanted to stay either. It was this, in addition to her fear of Beatrice, that squeezed yet more tears from her. The tears didn't make her any braver, however, so she left the letter clinging to the ladder, waiting to be discovered. "Beatrice," it began, "I am in love with Marisita Lopez."
Chapter 7. Pete Wyatt woke as a stranger in the world of miracles. He was neither a saint nor a pilgrim. He was just a kid waking too late in the morning in the back of a stranger's egg-yellow Mercury. Wiping the sweat from his forehead,
he slithered into the boastful sunshine outside. The settlement's appearance surprised him. It was not at all what he'd imagined in the darkness the evening before. Bicho Raro, by night, was a god. Bicho Raro, by day, was a man. In the raw daylight, it was a place people lived, a place where a young man could work for a box truck. One would think this unveiled truth would be encouraging, but it had the opposite effect on Pete. His journey before now had felt like a dream, and a dream can always be changed into something else. But when you are awake, the truth is bright and stark, not as willing to bend to the mind's will. So now Pete truly faced the reality of the plan he had made. He pressed a hand to his heart again, and wondered if he had made a mistake. Perhaps, he thought, he had overestimated himself. Perhaps a place this vast and an adventure this curious were only for those without holes in their hearts. Closing his eyes, he thought of his father. George Wyatt was a man of action. George Wyatt had been supposed to die in the womb, as his umbilical cord had been wrapped around his neck, but he decided that death was not for him and had chewed himself free. He'd been born 2 weeks early, his baby hands still clutching the ragged stump of his umbilical cord, his baby mouth already full of teeth. He'd been the weakest of his 8 siblings, but he'd begun lifting weights as a toddler, and by the time he was 15 he could lift all of his siblings at once. His family had been dust poor, and he was meant to be too, but he'd signed himself up for the army and worked hard. He saved a full colonel from choking on his rations in the field by punching him in the face and telling him to snap out of it, and was made an officer. George Wyatt would not have allowed himself to be disheartened at this early stage. Pete opened his eyes. Resolve straightened his spine. He would search for someone who knew about his deal to work for the box truck. Back in Oklahoma a few years before, he had enjoyed a brief stint as a firehouse fundraiser. After a particularly difficult winter, the town's only fire truck had gone out of commission. An excess of chimney fires and poverty had clogged the fire truck's hose with prayers and despair, and it had split from end to end. Pete had taken up a successful collection to replace it, going from door to door with a smile and a pledge sheet. He knocked on doors now with the same vigor, but got a very different response. Although he was certain there must be people inside the buildings, every door remained closed to him. He got the sense that he was being watched, too, that eyes were on him through the windows, eyes that disappeared as soon as he squinted in their direction. At one point he even heard a baby cry out, hurriedly shushed as he knocked on Rosa Soria's camper door. The problem was that he looked like a pilgrim. All of the Sorias knew that pilgrims had arrived the night before, and all of the Sorias knew that a miracle had taken place. They assumed that Pete had received the miracle alongside Tony, and therefore they would not risk speaking to him. Ordinarily, Danielle might have risked it, but today he was as absent as the others. Pete did not know why he was being avoided, only that he was. He did the only thing he could think to do. He began to work. He chose the log lodge site for his attention. Michael had made himself scarce as soon as Pete began to move about Bicho Raro, and it is difficult to jump usefully into the middle of someone else's tasks without instruction. But Pete had a lot of practice helping. Good helping is generally about taking quick and accurate stock of another's needs, and that was what he did now. He saw that dimensions for the lodge had been marked out, and he also saw that some holes had been started, and that it was slow going because of the rocky soil. He thought about what the unseen architect of this project might need, and then he began to move all the rocks from inside the dimensions of the lodge to the outside.
The occupants of Bicho Raro watched him work. They watched him remove enough rocks to fill the wheelbarrow parked by the lodge site. They watched him remove enough rocks to pile one cairn, then two cairns, then three. They watched him remove enough rocks to begin to build a small structure beside it. He did not have the material to build a roof or put in glass windows or hang a wooden door, but he built four walls and a fireplace in the corner and had just begun on decorative window sills when he ran out of rocks. That was when Antonia Soria realized that she knew who he was. Antonia was the one who had originally proposed the idea of labor for truck to Pete's aunt, sometime after Josefa had been cured with her second miracle, but sometime before she had left Bicho Raro. They were always short of hands, and it seemed to Antonia to be an ideal solution for disposing of the broken-down box truck. Antonia put down her scissors. Whenever she had a spare moment, she constructed elaborate paper flowers so realistic that sometimes even the flowers forgot they were not real and wilted for want of water. It was a painstaking process that required hours of concentration, and being made to stop in the middle put her in a terrible rage. Her desire to officially hire Pete warred with her hatred of interruption. The former won, but was a bitter victor. Here was a thing Antonia wanted, to suck honey off a man's finger. Here was a thing she feared, that she would forget to shout at one of her family members, and this family member's lack of care would lead to her house catching on fire. With a furious exhalation, she rose from her paper roses. Securing her hair in a smooth bun, she pinched her cheeks a few times before marching out to Pete.
"Are you Josefa's boy?" she asked.
Pete had one remaining stone in his hand, which he put down in a hurry. He could see that she was angry, and thought that he was the reason.
"Her nephew, ma'am, Pete Wyatt."
"What?"
"Wyatt."
Antonia's annoyance at being interrupted faded as she looked at the structure he had started.
"Shake my hand," she told Pete, and he did. "Antonia Soria."
"Sora, ma'am?"
"Soria."
Now she studied him closely.
"Are you sure you don't have darkness in you?"
"No, ma'am, I just got a hole in my heart."
"That hole in your heart going to kill you if you work too hard?"
The doctor who had diagnosed Pete, a man also named Pete, had explained that the hole in his heart was vulnerable to extremes of emotion, like shock, fear, and the complicated feelings one has when discovering other people want you dead, and generally, all the things one might expect to encounter in the army. Pete the doctor told Pete the patient that as long as he lived in moderation and avoided situations where unexpected extremes of feeling might come at him, he would never notice the lack. As his parents and younger brother Dexter looked on, Pete the patient had asked if he could simply train his mind and join the army anyway. Pete the doctor said he was afraid not. Pete the patient would always be the weakest link. Then he wrote, "Unfit for duty." Pete thought about this again, and he thought about Beatrice and the desert. Then he said,
"No, I don't think so, ma'am. It's only shock that does it."
"Good. Very good," Antonia repeated. "Come on, I will show you where you'll put your boots at night."
As Pete fetched his bag from the car, Antonia spared a bitter glance at her husband Francisco's greenhouse. He was visible through the glass. While his wife spent her nights making paper flowers so beautiful they seemed real, Francisco spent his days growing real flowers so beautiful they seemed fake. Although the San Luis Valley was a good place to grow sturdy potatoes and hay and tomatoes, Francisco had instead turned his attention to raising roses. There were many impediments to growing show roses in Bicho Raro: hail to knock the petals off, and elk to eat the leaves, and searing sun to bleach the color from them all. But as a boy, he had been struck by the perfect beauty of a Fibonacci spiral in a rose's belly, and had never lost the fire. Since then, he had been trying to breed the impossible, a black rose. He was in the greenhouse now.